Hello and welcome to Uncovered Witness Fire Science Revelations. My name is Wojciech Wierzyński. I'm a professor at the Building Research Institute ITB in Poland, and I specialize in fire science. Indeed, I get paid for setting things on fire and getting the most knowledge out of the burns that we do. In this podcast, I will be your host, the narrator, and perhaps even a guide, if I may. And I will not be here alone. I will be joined by world-class experts. I will try to bring fire science and fire safety engineering a little closer to you, whether you are an experienced fire safety expert or someone who is touching the subject of fire professionally for the first time. I will provide you with content that will guide you through the most interesting and challenging parts of the fire science. And one thing that you can quickly learn when you touch fire science is that even very simple things can become extremely complex if you ask the question how and why enough times. This project is created together with Halliwell Fire Research. Halliwell is a company that specializes in forensic fire science and witness services, as well as research development and design of evacuation in buildings. And together with experts of Halliwell, we have prepared few very interesting topical clusters to which we will go in depth, starting this week with the means of escape.
It remains as the 12th deadliest single building fire.
How representative is it of reality?
Lawyers often refer to as the industry standard.
Data that was collected in the 50s, 60s, and 70s has been criticized for being for a population of that time.
What are the ignition sources? What things can ignite?
This is Uncovered Witness, the fire science revelations. So how relevant are means of escape to people inside and outside of the fire safety ecosystem? Probably at some point if in your life you've met a situation in which someone would like to put a lot of people into one room and someone would step up and say, no, it's not allowed due to fire safety regulations. There's a fire marshal that will not allow this many people in this occupancy. Why is that? Why do we enforce a specific number of people in a specific room? It must have something to do with fire, right? Evacuation, ability to escape. And yes, this is true. But when you start figuring out how we come to the number, how do we realize which amount is safe, you will quickly realize that between countries, those numbers are vastly different. You will also see that it's not just the only sole variable that defines if a building is safe or unsafe. One of many things, and usually when an investigation happens, it rarely was one simple reason for a tragedy. Usually it was a cascade of effects. Regardless, in this episode, we will focus on the very basic question, how many people can you fit into a room safely, thinking only about the ability of them to exit the room or the capacity of the room to allow for safe evacuation of those people. So let's start digging, and it's very difficult to define when we've started caring about the exit capacity of our rooms, compartments, and buildings. I'm not a historian nor an architect, but I can claim that exits are as old as buildings, or perhaps even older, because humankind has lived in non-anthropogenic spaces before we started building buildings. But one can argue they were there for all kinds of reason. I'm not sure if evacuation was one of them. Eventually, we've started building bigger and larger objects that could host hundreds or thousands of people. And I'm really curious how, for example, designers of Colosseum or giant cathedrals have chosen their exit capacity. They must have realized that there's a relation between the size of the opening and the amount of people that can come out of it. And most likely it was through experience and timing these processes based on previously built buildings. In fact, building science and construction are fascinating fields of engineering sciences because in most of the cases we figured out how to build buildings safely before we started explaining why they are safe indeed. An interesting story about defining the evacuation time is related to one particular fire in Edinburgh, the Empire Palace Theatre, where in 1911 there has been a fire and there was seemingly 3,000 people in the theater. And the story says that the audience was let
known about the fire by the orchestra, which started playing the Britain's national anthem, God Save the King. And by the end of the anthem, everyone was out. Also, the history shows that theaters at that point were places of the most vicious and destructive fires that took the most lives. In this case, everyone got out safely, so one could assume that this amount of time was very fine to evacuate everyone to their safety, and perhaps became a reference point for the definition of how much time do we need to escape. In fact, later on in British legislation, 2.5 minutes to evacuate such a venue was put in place as a regulation. I'm not sure if this story explains the reason for the regulation, but certainly a time has appeared in our law system. But that's yet not engineering itself. The engineering came a little bit later, and to touch the origins of the means of escape calculations, I've invited Professor Daniel Nielsen from University of Canterbury and the director at Halwell Fire Research. So what were the first instances when we've used real research, real data, real models to explain the movement of people in different compartments?
A lot of the data that we use today was actually from transport research, and it was an increased use of subways around the world, for example, in Japan and in Russia or the Soviet Union at that time, and the US, where they started getting an increased demand on the metro systems. So there are studies, for example, by Togawa in Japan, Przyszynski-Milinski in the Soviet Union, and John Fruin in the US, who looked at commuters and how commuters move. And that is the data that we use today. Now, the reason why we use that data is that commuters move slightly faster than people in general. And it's the same for evacuations. People move slightly faster, and that's why we're using that data.
So with the first data available, with the first models available on the market, shared through the world, engineers gain ability to actually calculate the evacuation processes and design the buildings accordingly to the needs of those buildings. This also opens a new world where one person's designer's choices may have a significant impact over the cause and consequences of fire incidents. Well, that brought to us fire safety engineers and a lot of responsibility and perhaps even liability for the designs that we're doing. World in which we do need to have sound data, sound models, and proven solutions so that we know that what we design responds to the needs of the building occupants. And so in this new world in which the fire safety engineering finally exists, where did the first data come from?
Often when they did the data collection, they were observing commuters moving in the metro system. And then they developed equations or fundamental diagrams. So that's the relationship between movement speed and density, and also the flow versus density. And what you often did back then was that you did hand calculations, so back of the envelope calculations, to estimate how long it would take for a group of people to move from one space to another space or through an opening. Przyszynski and Milinski, they had a calculation method, which is still used in some places of the world, where you can draw up your geometries and calculate in quite an advanced way how long it takes for people to move out through a configuration.
Measuring the speed at which commuters move, calculating some baseline velocities, and just multiplying them with the baseline features of your building, that sounds quite simple. But at that point, we most likely also realized that there are fundamental relationships between the movement of a person in a free space and how a crowd does move. So the point of this research was not really just evaluating the velocities of humans. It was to evaluate those fundamental relations that allow us to understand what happens in a space as it gets crowded. Explaining these concepts to me, Luc Deschott, senior researcher from Halwell Fire Research.
Oftentimes, those ways will have some sort of understanding of a decrease in speed, let's say, with density. So one way we handle this is by the use of what's called a fundamental diagram. So this is essentially a way of describing the relationship between the density of a crowd and their movement speed or flow. It's a concept borrowed from traffic engineering, so with vehicles, but it's quite useful for pedestrian flow as well. Often the way this data is collected, it's very empirical in nature. So I think the first sort of time it was collected was probably around the 50s. So there were a couple of researchers in England that had people walking in a loop. and measured them walking in the loop. And they sort of said, what is their walking speed? And then they inject a few more people into that loop so they can really control the density. And then were able to form a relationship between occupant density and walking speed. They then sort of went ahead. And a lot of the times this data is collected in, I would say, subways and these sorts of things where you can have a very defined flow path. So a corridor, you know how wide it is. So you measure an area, a measuring zone, and you take some video footage. You measure it with a stopwatch and you basically count how many people are going through. You can go back and work out their density, and that's a data point. And you can plot a lot of these data points and start to get some sort of understanding of how people will typically move through that sort of geometry.
Is the data from OpenSpace also valid for clustered spaces like corridors? Does presence of obstacles or walls affect this relationship?
Well, oftentimes the relation does change when we're in a confined space. So you could think of humans as a fluid in some ways. So we're not going to walk exactly against the wall. We leave some sort of boundary layer. So some research suggests that's around 0.15 meters or thereabouts. And that's because we need some room for our bodies to sway when we walk. We move slightly back and forth. So we have some shoulder sway. And that shoulder sway changes as we change our walking velocity. It's more pronounced at lower speeds and really pronounced when we're walking on stairs as well. We move side to side quite a bit. But the fundamental diagram is really more around a crowd around you, and it kind of restricts your movements. So we kind of know this to be true when, I'm sure we've all had examples where, you know, we get up after a musical performance or in a stadium or something like this, and we walk freely to a queue, and then we just kind of jam up and shuffle back and forth until the density decreases to a point where we can kind of resume our preferred walking speed.
So is there one diagram that's fundamental to everything, or perhaps we've developed more of them? And how do they look like, really?
We often have quite a variety and variability in fundamental diagrams. So some of these differences can be attributed to things like the motivation. So has this data been collected from people walking down the street shopping on a Sunday afternoon? Or is it rush hour and people are bustling to get into the train? Or is it an emergency situation? Or is it a made-up experiment on a school basketball court with a bunch of students? All very different scenarios. So if we think about it in terms of, so we can talk about density in terms of like a global density around a person. And oftentimes in pedestrian movement experiments, this is effectively translated to a what we call a headway or interperson distance. So we often find that interperson distances of around, let's say, 2 meters, people will walk almost at an unimpeded walking speed, their preferred walking speed, and the density around them is such that it doesn't impede their flow. So they can walk at a, you know, this could be in the range of 1.2 to 1.4 meters per second. Depends on their motivation and what their sort of situation is, I suppose.
And physical fitness, right?
Absolutely. We'll find that this preferred walking speed, humans seem to be very adept at minimizing the expenditure of energy. So a lot of this is around the most efficient means of moving. And we see this when people transition from walking to running and then running back to walking again. And it's quite a predictable sort of transition point. And also you'll note that when people start walking, they'll get to a speed and then they'll stop walking one foot in front of the other. And then they'll transition to a sort of a shuffle mode where their feet don't really lift up at all. In terms of densities, we might talk about a jamming density of around 9 persons per square meter, which is very tight. It's not necessarily something you'd really get to unless you're at the front of a Taylor Swift concert or something like this.
So this is like a density at the opposite end when the movement is no longer possible, right? This is like the full stop.
Correct. So the crowd will get to a point where you'll have sort of effectively like a laminar flow. So this is where people are just walking in one direction, and then you'll get to a point where the density raises. And then you'll shift to a turbulent mode where people are moving around. And you often see this at Hajj pilgrimage, for example. You'll see people moving in a big crowd, and then they'll jam right up and move backwards and forwards. And you get these stop and go waves where people are stopping, then they're walking, then they're stopping, then they're walking. And then sometimes they're even moving backwards away from the direction they intend to go. And density gets to a certain point where you can't pick up and move your feet anymore. And that's where it becomes a real danger, where we have these sort of crowd crush situations where people are no longer in control of their own bodies and they're at the mercy of the crowd around them.
So indeed, we have already observed a lot of different behaviors at the loop. We've learned how to calculate the walking speeds and time that will take a person to move through a specific distance. We've also learned how much time it will take them to queue up at the doors to finally pass through the doors. We've learned how this will change with the more people coming and the density of population increasing. However, this is still based on the data from 50s, 60s, 70s. The world looked quite different back then. I wonder to what extent the data collected back then is still relevant. With this question, I went back to Professor Daniel Nielsen.
The data that was collected in the 50s, 60s, and 70s has been criticized for being for a population of that time, which meant we were healthier, we were perhaps not as tall as we are today. So the main difference was our body size. And the body size definitely influences the flow through an exit. So the bigger you are, the fewer people you can fit through an exit per second. The example of this would be children. They're tiny. You can fit a lot of children through an exit. So the flow for children is much higher than it is for adults. And the argument then is that the data we collected in the 50s, 60s, and 70s isn't really relevant today, since we have a larger percentage of obese people. We're generally bigger than we were back then. So some of the developers of the original data sets have actually come out and criticized the data sets and said that we have to rethink what we do and maybe recollect the data. Or even better would be if we rethink how we model crowd flow through exits and use a more fundamental approach to look at the biomechanics of movement. So when a person moves in a crowd, they will adjust their movement speed as a function of the distance to the person in front. Now, there are several aspects that will influence how we adjust our speed in terms of the distance to the person in front. First of all, we have a certain step length, and we don't want to step on the heels of the person in front. So the longer we are, the longer legs we have, the longer step length we have. So a tall person, according to this theory, would keep a longer distance to the person in front, since they simply take longer steps. There is also an aspect that we have to consider, and that's reaction time. So if you have a short reaction time, you can probably keep quite close to the person in front, since you could quite comfortably stop, since you have a really short reaction time. Whereas if you have a slow reaction time, then you keep a longer distance to the person in front. And that could explain some of the differences between elderly and young people. So elderly seem to keep a slightly longer distance, and younger keep a shorter distance. And there are differences in terms of reaction time between elderly and young. But another factor could also be the comfort distance. Since if you're elderly, you might not feel as comfortable being very close to other people. Since if you fall or slip, you might fall into them. So you might want to leave a bit of a buffer to the person in front. Whereas if you're younger, you might not be as concerned, since you're not as afraid of falling, for example. So just by looking at those aspects of step length, reaction time, and this comfort buffer, or the distance that you comfortably leave to the person in front, my feeling is that we can build a fundamental correlation for movement in crowds. And that is potentially the way to go, rather than recollecting new fundamental diagrams.
And what about the disabled population?
Research which was done in the 50s, 60s, and 70s mainly focused on able-bodied people. So it was commuters moving in the metro system. And in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was mainly able-bodied who moved in the metro systems. So as far as I know, not much consideration was made of people with movement disabilities as an example.
So we have a pretty decent explanation of how this is measured and modeled, and perhaps how we can even improve this in the future. But we have not really asked the question why. Why at this point of time we started caring about it? What was the rationale? What was the reason behind taking the transportation research and applying it for fundamental human evacuation in buildings? This question was again asked Professor Daniel Nielsen.
There are a couple of disastrous, well, either nightclub or theater fires. What characterizes many of these fires is that they simply didn't have enough exits. So they didn't necessarily consider flow the way we did today, and they probably didn't know exit capacity as well as we do today. So many of the problems that caused the really big fatal fires were the lack of exits. You also had some issues back in the day of exits being locked, mainly to prevent people from coming in and not paying their ticket. And if you lock an exit, then you reduce the exit capacity even more, since you only have a very limited number of exits available for people. So those were some of the things that caused the really devastating fires back in the day.
Here, please allow me an observation of my own, where Daniel says, back in the day, from what I see, those tragic fires were the overcrowded spaces cause loss of life by dozens of people still happen today. And every few years we hear about a catastrophic fire, usually in some sort of a nightclub. Daniel said that perhaps back in the day we did not have this understanding of exit capacity that we have today. So let's learn from him what exit capacity is, how we define it, and how does it relate to designing a safe building.
The most important thing is that you have enough exit widths and enough number of exits as well, ideally placed in different parts of the building. So two emergency exits, for example, shouldn't be next to each other, since then one fire could take them out, both of them at the same time. So you should have them placed in different parts of the building, but also enough width to accommodate all the people who are trying to get out. Another thing you should always avoid is to have like a funnel. So if you do have a funnel, then there is a risk of pressure building up in that funnel. So a funnel would be when you have a wide width that goes into a very narrow width, and that can cause crowd pressure if you design it inappropriately.
Predefined exit widths is something that I also have in my code and something that I have to comply with. Whereas I accept that as a means of introducing a safe design into my buildings by a prescriptive flow, sometimes there's a battle with the commissioning firefighters about a centimeter or an inch of width that is missing. And when I was viewing those, I always wondered, does a centimeter make a difference in an evacuation process? Would a missing centimeter be a reason of liability or a good reason to not allow opening the building? Because I've seen such things happen in my low ecosystem. It's a tricky question, and I'm surely asked, Daniel, taking low requirements away, what difference does a centimeter make? And what are the potential consequences to the occupants of the building in that situation?
Probably in reality, it's not that precise. So if a centimeter is missing or not, probably wouldn't matter too much. But the rule of thumb is still that you add a number of centimeters per person that you add to the building, just to make sure that the total evacuation time doesn't become ridiculously long. 1 centimeter less or 1 centimeter more in a meeting room, for example, with a lot of people in it, it probably wouldn't matter too much. But the big difference would be if you have a 1 meter exit rather than the 2 meter exit, since that's a huge difference in capacity. But most building codes around the world, they have a design occupant density that determines how many people are in the building. And then typically you have a minimum exit width in most countries. And then the final variable would be that you add exit width per person you add to the room. So the more persons you have in the room, the wider the exits. So the way you decide the total door widths in most regulations around the world is that, first of all, you have 2 independent exits for all rooms, which have sufficient number of people. Then depending on the size of the room, you calculate how many people will be in this room. And it depends on if you have seats, for example, then it's typically the number of seats. But if you have an open floor area, then you multiply the floor area by a design density. Now, once you have that design density, then regulations typically provide you with an exit width per person in this room. And that gives you the total width of exits. And then another rule of thumb for all legislations that I've seen around the world is that you always have 2 independent exits. So 2 exits that cannot be taken out by the same fire. And different codes have different requirements. Some have a separation distance of 4 meters between these exits, for example, which is then considered to be far enough away from each other to not be taken out by the same fire.
So far, when brainstorming in this episode, we were considering pretty simple cases, evacuations from a large room or walking speed in a, let's say, not very confined or perhaps a little confined space. But the real challenge is when people flow from different places towards the same exit, especially when we start mixing occupants that come from the floors horizontally and ones that descend the stairs vertically through the common evacuation pathway for multiple floors. This is often the case in high-rise building evacuation, and indeed, the evacuation of such premises looks very different than evacuation of large open spaces. To bring me up on how the evacuation process and the calculations related to it look like for a high-rise building, I've brought again Professor Daniel Nielsen.
So evacuation of high-rises, I might actually go into the phased evacuation straight off. So today, when we evacuate high-rise buildings, they're quite large and you have a lot of people in high-rise buildings. So what you tend to do is you do a local evacuation first. So you do something called a phased evacuation. So if a fire is discovered on one floor, then you evacuate that floor first. Often you do evacuate floors above and below and or below at the same time. Now, the reason you do that is that if you did something called a total evacuation and evacuated the entire building at the same time, then you might get congestion, or you will most likely get congestion in the stairs. And if you get congestion in the stair, then the stairs will be crammed with people. And the risk is that not everyone on the floor will be able to get into the staircase, since they might have to be queuing out into the floor. And this is an issue for the fire floor, since they need to get out quicker. And that's why we have phased evacuation. So we prioritize those floors. Sometimes, if we have fire separation, that might be the only floor we need to evacuate. So the fire crew goes in, it might be a relatively small fire, you can extinguish it, and you don't actually have to evacuate the rest of the building. But if it is a big fire, then make sure that the fire floor, possibly the floors above and or below, are evacuated. And once they are, then you can trigger the alarm for the entire building. Now, due to merging, merging is when two flows of crowds meet. You will evacuate high-rise buildings, I would say, in an almost a counterintuitive way. So if you did a total evacuation, so that's the entire building at the same time being evacuated, which I would say is mainly relevant for bomb threats, where you don't really know where the threat is and you evacuate the entire building. Then at the bottom floor, the discharge flow from the doors at the bottom will be the flow that determines how quickly you evacuate the building. Now, on every single store, you will have what we call merging. So people will be coming out from the floors, or they will be coming from the top levels, and they will merge. And merging ratios can differ depending on the geometry, but on average, it's about 50-50. So one person from the floor, one person from the stair above. So if you look at the bottom floor, you will have people going out through the door. The discharge flow through the door to the street level will be the controlling variable. That would be the flow. And then on between the ground floor and the stair and all the people coming up from the stair, you will have a mixing of one person, one person, one person, one person. Then you go up to the next floor and you will have a mixing of one person, one person, one person, one person. The thing with going up into the building is that the discharge flow is going to be split 50-50 on every single floor. So the higher up you get in the building, the slower the movement will be if you do a total evacuation. So ironically, the top floors are the ones that you're going to empty out later, and the bottom floors you're going to empty out first. And where would it be more dangerous to be in a high-rise building? Well, smoke goes up, so it's most likely it's going to be in the top of the building if you get smoke entering the staircase, for example. So that's a bit problematic, that if you do a total evacuation, then we empty the building from the bottom and up rather than from the top and down. And smoke spreads the other way. So we've had cases like the MGM Grand fire, where there were some problems with seismic joints and ventilation systems and vertical shafts, and all the smoke went up to the top of the building and filled the top floors. And that is, ironically, where if you have a congested staircase, where people would be stuck the longest if you do a total evacuation.
So in this case, in case of high-rise buildings, the congestion is simply a feature of how the evacuation process can go if you execute the total evacuation. In this case, even if we would really like to, we're not really able to provide staircase with a size that would allow emptying every single floor at the same time. Perhaps you would need to build a staircase for every floor independently, which obviously would kill the purpose of the building to leave space to the tenants. Anyway, we've seen a lot of complex evacuation systems and scenarios. At this point, we have a pretty good overview of how do we measure, model, and implement in our codes the requirements for safe evacuation. Let's discuss what happens when these regulations are not met, when life goes different than we've designed as engineers. And unfortunately, there's way too many disastrous fires that we can connect to an overcrowded space or insufficient means of escape. Let's bring a few of such examples to illustrate our further discussion. We'll start with the tragic Beverly Hills Supper Club, which is explained to me by Josh Gibbons, a researcher at the Halliwell Fire Research.
So the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire was a fire in Southgate in Kentucky in the USA, which occurred on Saturday, May 28th, 1977. And in this fire, tragically, 165 people lost their lives. The Supper Club fire, and the Supper Club in general, was a restaurant and nightclub establishment. It contained about 18 different rooms that could be used for functions and events and weddings, that type of thing. And the complex had an overall floor area of around 6,100 meters squared. The building itself was initially constructed in 1937, but it had lots of expansions and renovations over the years as the club grew in notoriety and popularity. So the building was a bit of a rabbit warren. The building itself was also constructed of non-combustible materials. However, given its use, it was lavishly decorated inside with plush internal surface finishes as well. So the night of the fire, it is believed that the building had around 2,400 to 2,800 people inside, which was double what the building could safely accommodate if you were to use the NFPA codes at the time. And one of the function rooms, which was the largest, known as the cabaret room, which was a large dining restaurant room with a stage at the front. And this one had three times what it could safely accommodate as compared to the NFPA codes at the time. So of the 165 people that died in this fire, 160 of them were in the cabaret room itself.
An overcrowded space with a viciously growing fire, a concealed fire that took out so many lives, a tragedy indeed. And there's much more into the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire that we will be coming back through the series of this podcast. Another example, this time a little bit modern, is the Gothenburg nightclub fire that happened in 1998. And this time explained by Professor Daniel Nielsen.
The Gothenburg nightclub fire happened on the 29th of October in 1998. And it was a fire that killed actually more than 60 young people and more than 200 people were injured. Now, the nightclub was not actually a nightclub. It was a venue for meetings. But at this particular night, a discotheque was arranged at this nightclub. So the building was not designed for the number of occupants that were in the building at the time of the fire. And this is one of the main reasons that they had a fatal outcome from the fire. One of the things as well, which influenced the nightclub fire and the many fatalities from the nightclub fire, was that there was only one exit and it was a relatively narrow exit. And the alternative exit, the back exit, was filled with chairs that usually were in the room. And just to get a nice dance floor, they had piled the chairs up in the staircase, which meant it was blocked. And also this is where the fire started. And the fire had quite a bit of time to grow. And then when the door was open, it was developing into a really big fire really, really quickly and pumped smoke into the room really quickly. And the only thing remaining was the main exit, which was way too narrow for that many people who were in this nightclub or in this room. If, for example, like in this case, the room was not really designed as a nightclub, it wasn't supposed to have as many people in it as you did have on the night of the fire. That then meant that the total exit width was not up to code. So the exits weren't simply wide enough for people to get out quickly. So even with two exits available, I would say that it was most likely still not wide enough, since there were a lot more people in the room than you would. Now, if you change, let's say you have a factory and you change the type of occupancy to a nightclub, what you need to do is you need to review the design and calculate using the design density for nightclubs, how many people would be in the nightclub. And then most likely, if you're converting a factory to a nightclub facility, you will have to build more exits, more exit width, since a factory might be 10, maybe 20 workers, whereas a nightclub could be 500 or 1,000 people in the nightclub. So you will have to add more exits to the design.
My immediate thought to that is something that we've started the episode with. Why don't we have a fire marshal that tells people you cannot have this many people in the room? But in fact, where in most of the buildings that would be the case, the unfortunate events happen in which it is not.
There are cases where it has failed. One of the issues with many of these cases is that there is no fire marshal on the scene when this ad hoc discotheque is arranged. So it's really hard to catch these types of incidents where it's a spur of the moment, a one-off where they had a nightclub or a discotheque in a room which wasn't designed for nightclubs or discotheques. And this is something that is really, really difficult to catch, since you have to be there at the right time as a fire marshal to discover this.
So for now, let's assume that in the world where we design fire safety of the buildings, where fire safety engineers are doing their job, where architects are doing their job, where authorities are enforcing the regulation and the world is built to safe standards, how do we really implement the knowledge that comes from the research and the tragic events like the ones mentioned before into real engineering projects? How do we translate from the mountain of science that is behind us into engineering practice and designing the next nightclub, the next office, or the next factory? The design process explained to me once again by Professor Daniel Nielsen.
The most straightforward way would be to use the prescriptive regulations. So the prescriptive regulations would tell you how many exits you need, and it would give you a design density, so number of persons in the room you're evacuating, and that would then give you the total exit widths, which should be divided by in two different directions. So they should be able to take one out of two different directions. So if you're doing a prescriptive design, that's part of your toolset. If you're doing a performance-based design, then you could either do hand calculations or back-of-the-envelope calculations of egress, which works for relatively uncomplex and small geometries. We're looking at a room with a staircase, maybe a corridor outside. You could definitely do that with hand calculations. When it becomes more complicated, like a high-rise building, then hand calculations become quite difficult to do in an accurate way. And what you do instead is that you use computer models to simulate evacuation. The most fundamental and simple model was a coarse network model where you had arcs and nodes. So you have nodes, which would be the rooms, and arcs connecting the rooms would be the exit pathways. And then people were put in these nodes, and in the model, they were transported along the arcs to the nodes. And then if you build up a node, an arc network, that would be a representation of their building. Now, those were the first types of models that were developed. The next step was to use something called fine network models, which is like a chessboard approach, where you have a square, and the squares, they can have different sizes, but often in many models, they're about half a meter by half a meter wide, so that you can fit about four persons per square meter. And each cell would then be able to accommodate one person. So it's like playing chess, basically moving your chess pieces, which are the people evacuating the building, from chess square to chess square. And those are the fine network models. The more current way of modeling it, or the more advanced way of modeling evacuation, is to do a continuous model. So rather than having the chessboard approach with different chess squares and people moving between chess squares, a person has a body size and they're within the confines of the walls. And then there are rules for movement of these agents in the continuum to make sure that they don't bump into each other and they keep a certain distance to each other. And that type of model is called a continuous model. And the one that I would say is used a lot today.
As someone who's also a user of those models, as someone who's designing evacuation from real buildings in my engineering practice, I also know one challenge that comes from this type of study. In the end, from your calculations, you not only receive the numbers that tell you how much time it takes to evacuate your building, but you also receive those beautiful fancy animations of humans walking through the corridors of the building you have just simulated, and it looks really realistically. Often our investors ask us for those types of animations, and this type of supplementary material is used to convince authorities or others that the building design is safe. And the real trick is that whereas the movement aspects of those agents walking through the building is captured quite well based on everything we've learned so far in the episode, their behavior is steered by very simple algorithms. And I often have to explain that this is not really modeling a true evacuation process, because in a true evacuation process, we will have much more happening than just the movement of people. I've asked the same question. Can we really model behavior, and does this simulation capture the human behavior in it, to Professor Daniel Nielsen, to see what is his thought about it?
It is something we're constantly working on. So there are models that claim to consider some behavior, like wayfinding behavior. Some those models rely a lot on the engineer to specify values, like probabilities of choosing one way versus the other way, or probability of seeing a sign, as an example. But there are models that have tried to start to implement the behavioral aspects, but most of the features of the models are still pedestrian dynamics and pedestrian movement. And those are the things that, that's the thing that models are really good at replicating, the movement and interperson distance. So it is a really valid tools to use for pedestrian flow calculations.
Human behavior in fire, that's a rabbit hole that is worth exploring. And I can promise you in a few weeks, we will have an entire series dedicated to that. But for now, let's summarize what we've learned about the means of escape. So we've walked our way from Colosseum to the modern times, learned from where we found the knowledge on human movement in fires, learned how can we calculate the flows of people in buildings, what happens when this go wrong, and what modern tools we have to assist us in the most challenging and complex projects. This knowledge can help us avoid another Gothenburg fire. This knowledge can help us design a safe space from which the evacuation flow is seamless. This can help us build a safer sports arena in which you can host your next bigger Taylor Swift concert with even larger crowd densities than before, and yet make sure that everyone in there is safe. But that's today. There's also future. And for future, we have some very interesting technologies that are within development. In the future, we will upgrade our understanding of the movement of people in crowded spaces and perhaps optimize our fundamental diagrams and models even more. How can we improve our understanding of pedestrian mechanics and how people move? This question is answered by Luc Deschott, who is a PhD candidate on this particular subject.
So this is an interesting one. My research is purely around movement, so I'm trying to establish a method to collect data to better inform some of those microscopic models. So theoretically, we could observe a person in a crowd and understand some of these microscopic changes in their gait as the density around them is changing. However, one of the main issues we have there is this concept of occlusion or crowd blocking, if you like, where, say, for example, I want to see how a person's step length or step width is changing over time and with different densities. I can't actually observe that in a crowd. I can see the top of their head if I have a camera overhead, but I can't see what their feet and what their hands are doing specifically, particularly when the crowd gets dense. There are a few technological ways around that. So we can use sensors. So IMUs, for example. However, they've got a few issues as well. So we have a lot of sensor drift and we get inaccuracies that sort of accumulate over time. So one of the ways that in my research, we're trying to get around that is to take the physical crowd away and insert a virtual crowd. So put people in virtual reality and then simulate a crowd around them. And the beauty of this is that we can have a pretty high degree of experimental control. So we can apply the exact same stimulus, you know, the environmental conditions, the appearance of the people, their exact spacing, their speed, their sort of emotional responses to a range of different participants, not only in the same country, but around the world as well. So it opens up a really nice avenue for collection of data. Unfortunately, one of the things that we don't have around VR, or one of the cons, if you like, is the fact that it's not reality. So people are going to behave differently. And this is always one of the critiques is around the validation. So yes, you've got a beautiful looking simulation, but how represented is it of reality? So that's where my work is really looking at. Can we use this methodology as a way to collect new data? And some of the things we've found so far is that even without people, just walking in a virtual environment by itself often results in a more sort of cautious gait. So we see people taking shorter steps, they slow down, and this is just with unimpeded walking.
The development is not just within the space of models. The development is also how we build our buildings and what we equip them with. If you look at the building built today and one 50 years ago, the ones built today are really technological marvels fit with networks of sensors that know everything what's happening in them. Can we use this for the purpose of helping building drive the evacuation process and help us apply all the models and solutions we've just discussed for sort of a real-time adjustments of the evacuation process on the fly? This question I've asked Josh Gibbons, who's working on developing new non-intrusive ways to estimate how many people are there in parts of the building.
So in terms of optimizing evacuations, You know, buildings are getting larger and more complex, and occupant wayfinding can become increasingly challenging and suboptimal. So one suggested and potential method to improve this is through dynamic crowd management. This is essentially an iterative process utilizing real-time simulation modeling and evacuation simulations. But a kind of key cycle or key component of that cycle is knowing the information on the number and location of people. And that's really just to guide them to the most appropriate and efficient exit. So we have camera-based technology specifically designed for the task of counting people. Very accurate technique to count people. However, it's very dependent on constant line of sight. It's also very expensive technology, and it's also intrusive on occupant privacy. So those are the cons and the drawbacks of camera-based technology. Can also have tags. So when people kind of sign into buildings using their fob cards and that type of thing, it's possible to have an idea, but it's very crude in that sense, using that as a method as well. But there's Wi-Fi based signatures, which send pings to occupant devices. And that's a relatively accurate technique as well. However, it's very energy intensive for the owner of the device and the building operator, as well as people have multiple devices. So there may be multiple pings from one person. Indoor environmental sensors can be used. So these are very common in buildings. So this is measuring relative humidity and temperature. And so this isn't a very accurate technique, as it's very much driven by the building ventilation system. And then there's also demand control ventilation, which is where we focused our research, which is a non-intrusive form of occupancy detection. And it's through carbon dioxide sensing, which is typically integrated with the building ventilation system as well. So some of the research that I was doing was looking at, okay, well, how can we gather this information? And so there are sensors already installed in buildings that can count people. And well, the most accurate sensors on the market would be camera-based technology and software capable of counting people. However, it requires constant line of sight and obviously no obstructions within that line of sight. It's also very expensive and it's intrusive on the occupants in the spaces as well. So the way we wanted to look at this research was, well, can we use sensors and systems already installed in buildings? And can we use the information that's measured there for alternative purposes, given it's already there? You know, what can we do with it?
With concepts like this in development, perhaps in 50 years in future, we will look back at tragedies like Beverly Supper or Gothenburg Fire and wonder, how did the building lead to this disaster? In future, where one does not need the fire marshal because the building knows how many occupants are there, without intruding their privacy, of course, we will be able to not just design better ways to escape, but also enforce those rules and perhaps prevent the tragedies that come from when these rules are not respected. In this episode, we've summarized just a little bit of evacuation science, which is the human flow calculations, how that relates to the exit capacity of buildings, and how this is used in the engineering and legislative process. We've talked about what happens when this is not respected and shown examples of tragedies when overcrowded space or not sufficient flow capacity of exits has resulted in significant loss of life. We've discussed where the data comes from, and we've discussed where the data could come from in the future. We've discussed the views from the past and compared them with some really great ideas for the future. But this is just the beginning. This is just the exit of your building. In the next episode of Uncovered Witness, we will discuss, how do the occupants even know that they are supposed to evacuate? How the fire safety engineer designs components of the building to assist that evacuation, and what purpose do they play in the escape? How do we notify the people? I mean, in not every building you have an orchestra playing God Save the King anthem. You would probably need something more reliable. And yes, it is installed in our buildings. In the next episode, we're gonna talk about the building technology and building systems meant to assist with human evacuation. And I can also tease the final episode of this mini-series. In episode 3, we will tap into one of the theories of human behavior to understand how we can design exits, paths, and signs
that help people escape, that are easier to interpret in a way that it really makes a difference. Something that's not prescribed in the law, something that is not defined by the codes and standard, but yet something that can make a huge difference. So please join me in those next episode of Uncovered Witness Fire Science Revelations. Huge thanks to my guests from this episode, Professor Daniel Nielsen, Luke DeShot, and Josh Gibbons from Halwell Fire Research. And big shout out to Halwell Fire Research for sponsoring the production of this show. See you in the next episode. Cheers.